but be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world.
We've already been reminded of so many important things. This day reminds us of the joy that undergirds our faith and the sorrow that undergirds our faith. And the songs that we sing express the whole range of reasons, and all the reminders that we've had keep our hearts before the God whom we serve and before the God whom we will stand before one day. And James aptly reminds us of the importance of that in every aspect of our life, reminding us that the mouth that has sung songs and the mouth that has said amen, God examines the worshiper to see if it's true worship, but then God doesn't check out, God doesn't clock out. He watches over us, he's caring for us, he's urging us to be holy in all of our conduct. And in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 15, Peter says it that way, reminding them of the age-old, long ago, the words having long ago been spoken, "Be holy, for I am holy." And he says there, "Be holy in all your conduct." So if we put Peter's words and James' words together, it would urge us, "Be holy in all of your speech." And so this morning, just want to offer four reminders to us, areas in which, as we studied last week, Satan tempted Jesus in every aspect, "Fall down and worship me." But if he couldn't get him to do that, then he would find some other, even just vain, not always overtly and obviously sinful thing to do, like jumping from the temple or, hey, just turning some stones to bread. That could be useful. Satan went back again and again after the Savior. And so he pursues us from every angle that he can. And so let's consider this morning the area of our speech. First of all, "Be holy in all of your speech" urges us to tell the truth and not lies. How simple that is to some degree in our society. Our society is built on credit in many ways, and credit implies a degree of trust between people. But God is the foundation and the fountain of truth. Satan, we know, is the father of lies. Of course, one of the first problems that we are told of in the beginning of the gospel among the Lord's people was the problem, very simple problem that causes great complications, that came from lies. Ananias and Sapphira told lies. Peter told the truth. You know, Peter could have the knowledge that was given to him, it appears, was from the Holy Spirit. Miraculously, he knew that they were lying to him. But Peter could have just kept that quiet, but he didn't. Peter told the truth, and Ananias and Sapphira told lies. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25, Paul urges us this way: "Therefore, put away lying. Let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor." Colossians chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, you may have noticed in your studies often, Ephesians and Colossians are like a commentary on one another. And so similarly, Paul says there, "Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him." Notice in these two verses the reasons that Paul gives, not only for avoiding lies, but also, equally important, that we speak the truth. Speak the truth with your neighbor, for we are members of one another. And don't lie, because you've put on the new man. And in this new man, you have new knowledge. You have a new way. Do you have to be a Christian in order to know you ought to tell the truth? No. But you have a new reason for telling the truth and a new reason for not telling lies when you are in Christ. Because you're made now, you're created in God's image, but now you've been born again. You're made again in His image. And so God doesn't lie. God never approves of lies. I've heard on more than one occasion, even from preachers, that, well, if it's to save lives or for some other reason, then God permits lying. I don't see God lying for any such reason, nor approving of such. Now, some may lie, and they may not be caught in this life. And Paul tells Timothy that in regards to any sin, that some men's sins are clearly evident, preceding them to judgment. Everybody knows about it, and so it's not going to be a surprise at the day of judgment. But then those of some men follow later. That might have been the case with Ananias and Sapphira. If Peter's knowledge was miraculous, then under any other circumstance, that would have happened. People would have gained confidence. Oh, look how generous they are. They were willing to sell their land just like Barnabas. And so a great reputation could have been built there. A lot of trust in people who did not deserve trust could have been built. But even if that happens in this life, then Paul reminds Timothy that some men's sins will follow them to judgment. Of course, as many people, a little at a time, are convinced in our society, if there is no God, if there is no judgment, then that's not just a hypothetical, theoretical discussion. The rubber meets the road at subjects like this. If that's the case, then what's the difference in telling the truth or telling a lie? What is right or wrong? What's better or worse? Everything becomes relative. But it is not relative. John reminds us that all liars shall have their part in the lake, which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. John joins Peter, and John joins James to urge us, be holy in all your speech, tell the truth, not lies. Holiness in all of our speech means all of our speech comes out in the form of genuine concern and not any form of gossip. Gossip is a little bit hard to define. When I looked at an English dictionary, it said telling things that are of a personal or sensitive nature. Well, we do talk about things that are of a personal nature. I've never found a real good definition of it. The word gossip is rare in the New Testament, but there are other words that are more common that would be associated with it. You'll find words like talebearer, or busybody, or whisperer. And does that mean it's sinful to whisper? Well, again, the context there is showing that there's a reason that there's whispering, and it's not out of genuine concern. There's some other motive that's working there. The word gossip appears in the New King James in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 13 of the younger widows. He says they learned to be idle and gossipers. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20, just in a list of various sins, the New King James says whisperings. The New American Standard there translates that as gossip. So just a very more common sense as opposed to a dictionary definition. Gossip is typically just the repeating things or telling things that should not be repeated. So what falls into that category? What should or shouldn't be repeated? If you want to turn to the book of Proverbs, we'll be looking at several Proverbs. Well, gossip may be the repeating of things that are simply not my business. In 1 Thessalonians 4:11, that's just how Paul says it, that every man work with his hands and mind his own business. So there are some things that just don't need to be repeated because they're not of my concern. Now, when I am genuinely concerned about other people, are some areas of their life my business? Well, yes, I am my brother's keeper. And so that's where typically the line between genuine concern and gossip is often the purpose and the motive for what is said. And so let's dig into some some Proverbs. Proverbs 11 and verse 13. It says, a talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of private spirit conceals a matter. So, again, there are some things that should not remain a secret. There are some things that need to be known. Go back to Peter and the example there. What he knew was a secret between Ananias and Sapphira, and it was a secret revealed to him by the Holy Spirit, but that did not need to remain a secret. On the other hand, there are things that are a secret that need to remain a secret. Look also at Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 19, and notice the two things that are associated here. A talebearer often does what else? It says, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. Sometimes the talebearer, before he tells the secret, he starts with some form of flattery. Like, well, I couldn't trust anybody else but you. And that's just setting the stage. Or, you know, he's really a nice guy, but... And that's just setting the stage, just buttering the bread before it's given. Now, again, out of genuine concern, that statement could be made that, look, I need to talk to you about something, and I trust you. And when it's genuine concern, that's not flattery. But when it's said for some other reason and some other purpose, exactly the same words, but for a different purpose, reveals a secret that needed to remain a secret. So flattery and gossip often go together. There is some form of selfish purpose, and it may lie under the surface. It may not be obvious, and depending on the person, sometimes even it isn't as obvious to them. But Proverbs 26, verses 22 and 23 describes the response of the person who is loose with their words in these ways. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles. So there's the pleasure, just like we know the pleasure of eating. Well, they get a pleasure out of telling. And they go down into the inmost body. What we eat may taste, may be welcomed by the tongue, but not so much by the belly. And the point here is what they tell also affects them. Fervent lips with a wicked heart are like earthenware covered with silver dross. So earthenware is pottery that's made out of just clay. Oh, but it's covered in silver. Again, the flattery often is hiding that there's something that is really useless underneath, and even worse than that. So it tastes good, it feels good because of pride or jealousy or revenge or bitterness. And so something is told out of selfish purposes. Now, is all talking about other people gossip? No, I can talk about people out of genuine concern. So, again, motive is a big part of this, but if I'm genuinely concerned about someone to the point that I'm talking about them, then eventually I'm going to need to talk to them. It may not always be immediate. Sometimes I need some advice before I talk to someone. So I may need to talk about them before I talk to them. But in that case, I'm not just talking about the problems, if I'm talking about them. I'm also talking about the solution. And I'm including myself in the solution to help this one with the problem. That's the nature of genuine concern that helps us to work through gossip. It's helpful to consider that. Sometimes we can go to an extreme and say, well, I don't want to gossip, so I'm not going to talk about anybody else. Well, we do have to. You can't read the Bible and not read about somebody else. God tells us about somebody else. In 1 Corinthians 1, the household of Chloe wrote to Paul about somebody else. But was that gossip? Or were they writing out to him, talking about others, talking about the sins of others, out of gossip or genuine concern? That's the difference between the two. The Proverbs helps to peel those layers back to help us to see the root. Gossip causes unnecessary strife. Proverbs 26 and verse 20, where there is no wood, the fire goes out, And where there is no talebearer, strife ceases. Go back to chapter 16, verses 27 and 28. When sharing information will cause unnecessary strife, then it falls into this other category. An ungodly man digs up evil, and it's on his lips like a burning fire. A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. So again, in these cases, it isn't limited to what is said. It's the purpose and the reasons and the results, all of the combination of those things, of what is said. Turn to Matthew chapter 12, verses 35 through 37. And what Jesus says here, he isn't specifically talking about gossip, but he just talks about our speech in general. And I think it helps with this, again, so that when we are very conscientious, we don't want to go to the extreme of gossip. But again, we need to remember sometimes we need advice. And before helping others, we need some help in knowing how to help them. And so Jesus' words here are helpful. Matthew chapter 12, 35 to 37. A good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good things. And an evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth evil things. But I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. So exactly the same words. I'm going to give you several examples here. Exactly the same words can be spoken, and with one motive, they're helpful, they're edifying. With a different motive, exactly the same words could fall into the category of gossip. So what we just noted previously was gossip may be something that's not my business. It needs to remain a secret. It has some selfish purpose for being shared and causes unnecessary strife. So think about a simple statement or question like this. Who chose this color carpet? Now, that could be out of genuine concern because, man, they did a good job, and I want to encourage them. They really handled that well. Everything went smoothly. I want to know who did that. But the same words could be said, who chose this color carpet? And a very different purpose. It may not be my business. It may not really matter who chose it. It may be causing unnecessary strife. But it's exactly the same words. Did you hear about the business meeting? Well, that could be said because, well, did you know we're having one? Or there's some information you needed to know? So that isn't gossip. But if there was something discussed at the business meeting that needs for some purpose, for some amount of time to remain a secret, well, then that could be the lead-in to gossip. Did you see how she was dressed? Well, that can be said out of genuine concern. I am my brother's keeper. And if she needs some teaching, some instruction, then that could be proper. That isn't gossip always. But if it's said because I've been admonished about the way that I've dressed, and so I'm just diverting and deflecting the attention off of myself, or if I'm saying that for some other purpose or to cause unnecessary strife, the same word in with one purpose can have a different consequence. Did you know she had a baby out of wedlock? Well, maybe that was so far in the past, it's totally irrelevant, and it's just not important. Or maybe it is helpful. Someone needs to encourage her. She needs some help. She needs to be admonished, or she's repented and she needs some encouragement. So exactly the same words you're seeing. Did you know that he was married before? Well, I am my brother's keeper. Does he need some instruction? Or, again, is that so far in the past and the situation is understood that sometimes it can just be left alone? He spent $10,000 on that. Well, he did really well. Or he's just frivolent, well, or frivolous. Well, he may need some help, some advice, or it may not be my business. So you get the point. Back to Matthew chapter 12, what Jesus said, a good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. An evil man, out of the evil treasure of his heart, evil things. Is it jealousy or genuine concern? Is it revenge or is it to restore peace? Is it to make myself look better or is it to make someone else look better? Is it to tear someone else down or is it to learn how to build somebody else up? Is it to warp an upright reputation or is it to warn of an ungodly reputation? All of these things are relevant factors in the words that we speak. And all of this helps us to distinguish between genuine concern and gossip so that we would be holy in all our speech. Next, go to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 4. Holy speech means using words that edify, that give grace in the sense of a blessing, of help. All of our words, should be the target that we're aiming at. Every word should edify and not corrupt. Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt word, notice even the precision there. He doesn't speak in a general way. Just be sure your speech as a whole is typically characterized by wholesomeness. I mean, there may be a few exceptions, but as a whole, I mean, he says every word, no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. So the King James here says corrupt. The New American Standard says unwholesome. Chapter 5 and verse 4 uses the words not that which is not fitting. So does that mean we just have to paint a pretend fake smile on our face and everything has to be happy and positive? Well, no, that actually doesn't edify. There are songs that remind us about our sin and the consequences of our sin. Those edify when we are reminded of things that need to change. That builds us up. Those are our words of grace. Paul told Timothy, when you preach the word, then you convince and you rebuke, and you exhort. All of those edify. So Paul isn't saying here, you just got to pretend and live in rainbow land, like everything is just happy and fine, and nobody ever does anything wrong. Or if they do, you just pretend it doesn't happen. That isn't what Paul is saying at all. But he is telling us, every word, or let no word that is corrupt proceed out of your mouth. Sometimes the question then is, okay, well, what makes a word corrupt? Which syllables in combination are sinful to speak? Who has the list of the forbidden words? And who gets to make that list? Well, of course, there is no such list. So how do we know which words fall into the category of corrupt and which help? Well, somehow without a list, in Matthew 26, when Peter was denying that he had been with Jesus and knew Jesus, remember it got to the point that he says he cursed and swore. Now, the Jews didn't have a list. There's not the 50 forbidden words in the Old Testament. Somehow without a list, Peter chose the words that would send the message that he wanted to send. That fell into the category of cursing and swearing. And so we don't need a list to be able to sort through the words that belong, the words that are wholesome, and the words that are corrupt. But maybe a better question is, well, which are the words, so that I memorize the list of words I shouldn't say? Maybe a better question is, what words will be good? What words will be useful to God and to people who will hear me in every situation and every circumstance, regardless of how easy or hard it is? And maybe that helps. Well, what speech is corrupt? There are some categories that sometimes we can use. Sometimes words are used in an overlapping general way. But the word profanity, sometimes that's just used of any kind of word we shouldn't speak. But more specifically, profane words are words that deal with God and his ways that are holy, and then using them in a way that is just common. It could be using those in a disrespectful way, but it could just even mean using those words in a common way. And I'm not giving examples this morning. I think we can figure that out and learn. But when we're frustrated or surprised or angry, then we've all heard and sometimes used God or Lord or other things like that, and that would be profane speech. Again, sometimes just cussing, it just means every form of word. More specifically, cursing, it's literal. To curse someone, to curse at someone means to say something that expresses a hope for harm, or to intentionally offend, or to insult, a threat. And so those would just be about any kind of word that would fall into the opposite category of Matthew 7 and verse 12. Whatever you would have men do to you, do also to them. Talk to them that way and not in the opposite. In Ephesians 5 and verse 4, he strings these three together. Filthy, foolish speech, and then coarse jesting. And the third is worth noticing. That word coarse jesting refers to innuendo, things that are implied that, well, I didn't say anything, but it's kind of with a wink and a nod and a smirk, and everybody understands the meaning that lies under the surface of those words. And so, again, there isn't a list, but we all, context helps us. We all know it when we hear it. Remember this verse, abstain from every form. Abstain from every form of evil, every kind of evil. And that's true in regards to our words, especially because the English language, people just find ways, they think, to get around the rules. And so how many words that fall into these categories, it just rhymes with the actual word. So here's the word everybody knows. So people say a word that rhymes with it, or they take one, it's a phrase, and so they start the phrase and they don't finish it. But what effect does that have? And I don't mean we started to say it and then we caught ourselves, but people who they intend, they say 90% of it or half of it, but they know when I say that, people can fill in the gap in their own mind, and that's what their words lead to. Well, all I've done in that case, I've just traded in one form of evil speech for another form. Again, the English language has so many words that there are words that have the same meaning as the overt and obvious offensive word. So we just change the form of the word, but it means the same thing. If you look it up in a dictionary, it means the same thing. We just altered it for some reason. Well, again, to think through that, all that is, it's sending the same message, just in a different form. Proverbs 10 and verse 19 says, in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking, but he who restrains his lips is wise. In some ways, we even have to stay up to date, because how many times have you heard someone say something and I don't even know what that means, as I'm in my 40s, and the longer that goes, I'm sure that'll continue to happen. So before I say something, maybe I don't need to have a multitude of words. I need to restrain my lips until I know the meaning of what I say. And we all have to do that. We pick up words, and our children do, from other people, or that we just said growing up, just because that's just what we heard our parents say when they hit their thumb with a hammer. It's just what they said. Well, do I know what I'm saying? Well, restrain my lips until I know what it means. Proverbs 17 and verse 27, he who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. The calm spirit helps me to analyze, what do I mean by that? And is it fitting? And does it offer any grace? Does it offer any help? Again, it doesn't mean it has to feel good to whoever hears it, but does it help? And yes, when I'm angry, when I'm frustrated, that is an opportunity to help people. It can be an opportunity to help them see how Christians ought to act in that situation. And there may be some problem going on that needs to change. And with understanding, with a calm spirit, I will be holy in all of my speech. It also means considering what do other people hear. Maybe I mean one thing, but if I'm not careful with my words, sometimes I send a message and people hear something different than what I say. So admittedly, the easiest thing would be if I could flash up the chart of the 50 forbidden words, but God didn't do that. What He's given us is the instruction to train our spirit, and our spirit trains our lips to be holy in all of our conduct. And then last, if you're in Ephesians, you can stay there. We read earlier from James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. And there James uses these words for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And so compare James chapter 1 with Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27. There are these two kinds of wrath or anger, especially if you run through the word wrath in a concordance. I don't know what percentage of time, but often wrath is associated with God. The Hebrew writer says, our God is a consuming fire, and I imagine that came out on some occasions when God was speaking to Moses or to Joshua or to Israel. So I don't imagine God's speech was always this just very light and just this always a friendly tone. I'm sure the tone was consistent with the message. So James tells us to be slow to speak, slow to wrath. Then Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27 says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. We discussed that last week. That opportune time that the devil saw, and so he returned to Jesus on multiple occasions. Paul says, don't let your anger be an opportune time for the devil. So anger is an emotion. Anger is a part of the way that God made us. It has a purpose, and God uses anger himself. So just like many other things, we just have to choose the kind that God, just like love, we choose the kind of love that is from God and not the kind of love that man invents and perverts. And so the same is true with anger. We need that slowness to wrath because I can look at my life and think about the rash acts, the quick decisions that were made primarily out of anger. And Moses is in that boat. He could look back to the rock. Why did he strike that rock? Because he was angry. He was frustrated, and he was even angry for a good reason. He was frustrated with the people's complaining and lack of faith, and yet that caused him to strike the rock. And we know the rest of that story. Saul was ready to pin David to the tent wall with a javelin. A rash act. Jeroboam, in 1 Kings 13, when the prophet came to rebuke him for building, offering the alternate places of worship, he pointed at the prophet and said, arrest him. And his arm, do you remember, withered just in that instant. Why was Stephen stoned by the Jews? With Jesus' crucifixion, that was well thought out. With the stoning of Stephen, it appears to be this kind of quick wrath and rash decision. It also, of course, leads to rash words. And yet the being slow to wrath helps prepare and prevent us from them. Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And usually as I read that, I think about it doing that for others, that a you know, soft answer will turn away their wrath. But that's not the limits of it, is it? If I have a calm spirit to give a soft answer, what does it do to my wrath? It doesn't make it go away, but it's like that fire. It keeps it in the pit. But the harsh words, the more harsh words I speak, what does it do? The flames inside grow bigger, don't they? Think about the importance of that. Being slow to wrath, having that time in between the anger strikes and the expression of it, that self-control and that sobriety, think about what that does. Look at Proverbs 14 and verse 29. Proverbs 14, 29, he who is slow to wrath, and so that's that phrase I suppose James was borrowing through the Holy Spirit, this phrase from the Old Testament. He who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. And then Proverbs 19, 11, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. In the process of that slowness, think about what can happen in that time. When I'm angry, but I'm slow to express it, it gives me time to analyze, do I have a legitimate reason to be angry? And Cain and Abel is the typical example of that. Cain was angry. Did he have a reason to be angry with Abel? No. Did he have a reason to be angry with himself? He did, and that's where that ought to have been directed. Do I have all the information? Do I have all the facts? When I was in my mid-20s and I needed a new telephone, so I went on eBay and found something, looked the right price and just what I needed, so I ordered it. Well, the box came, and I opened it, and inside were, I think, two packages of peppermints. And I was hot. I thought, they've already gotten my money, and I can't do anything about that. So I was ready to write them a hot letter. And then I thought, okay, I'll give them one chance. I mean, how is it even possible this could be anything other than a ripoff? But I'll give them one chance. So I wrote, and they replied apologetically and said, "We are sorry. This was a Christmas gift, and so when we unwrapped it, we thought it was a phone. We didn't need a phone, so we just put it on eBay. We'll send your money back, and you can keep the peppermints too." And I remember in that moment, remembering what I wanted to say at first, no way I could have come up with that as even a reasonable possibility. But time, and I am not the master of anger, but that was a lesson that has stuck with me. Self-control helps me to analyze, do I have all the information? Can I do anything about it? It helps me to ask, before I'm angry at them for doing that, am I guilty of the same thing? Because if I am, then let me channel that energy to pull this log out of my eye, and then I can help them. That slow spirit helps me to consider, will my reaction show Jesus in me or the world in me? And especially as we think about our family, what we do apart from our children forms the habits that ultimately God created us with buttons, and children usually end up laying a finger on those at some point or another. And if our reaction apart from them is not what it ought to be, then often that is where it will show itself. And so, not exclusively, but do not provoke your children to wrath would certainly include parents are controlling our anger, so that I don't curse at them when they curse, so that I don't destroy things because they destroyed things, so that I don't throw a tantrum because they threw a tantrum, so that I'm not disrespectful because they were disrespectful. And there's a difference between respect. I certainly understand that. But that calm spirit helps me to reflect on what I'm teaching. And maybe I'll say the least about this, but not because it's least important. What would the role of prayer be in helping me to calm my anger before I did anything? It won't change what's happening around me. What would the role of prayer do in training me to be slow to wrath and be angry and not sin? I can't always do it, but what if I prayed with the person that I'm angry with? Again, in the home might be where that is more possible, not always possible. But parents, would this help train our children if we even teach them, before you're angry with your brother or sister, y'all go over, you'll pray together, and then y'all solve the problem. I'm learning. I can't solve every problem, every fuss. I wouldn't be able to preach the gospel if I did. There's plenty of those to go around. Training our children how to work through anger and problems. First, they have to see it from us. What role would prayer play in training my mind and to be slow to wrath, to be holy in all my speech? And so we take seriously the responsibility to worship the Lord in spirit and in truth, and rightfully so. And let's let all of our life reflect the holiness and the reverence and the humility and the honor that God deserves as we speak to Him and as we speak to those who are, as James 3 says, those who are made in His image. God is using our words to be salt and to be light, and He uses our lives and uses our words when we are holy in all of our speech. When Paul said that, he wasn't saying all of your speech, past, present, and future, you have no hope to get into heaven unless all of it has been holy. That's why Jesus came. Jesus came because my speech has not always been holy. So what must I do to be saved from unholy speech or any sin? We sing the song to urge you to reflect on God's answer to that question. And if your unholiness, if you recognize that has separated you from God, then accept the offer and the forgiveness and His long-suffering and His mercy. And if you're not a Christian, then confess your faith and be baptized. And the blood of Christ will make you holy and train you in holiliness. That's the commitment that you have made as a Christian. And if you need to return to that commitment and to that God, and we can help you and encourage you in doing that in any way, we can stir you up to love and good works. Come tell us how as we stand and sing.